So, ladies and gentlemen, I am supposed to moderate this panel, and you will see immediately that moderation will be needed. It's a very high-powered panel with chairmen of the leading organizations in the world in the field of securities regulation, and you will see they are coming from almost all parts of the world. I start with the Far East, if I may call that this way, which is Ashley Alder, who is coming from Hong Kong. He's the CEO of the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission. Next, I go then to Greg Metcalf from Australia. We have already heard where he is chairing ISIC. And then go further to the extreme west, Howard Weston, who is from the Ontario Securities Commission. In between, Stephen Mayor, who is chairing ESMA, standing for all European securities regulators. And then finally, but not least at all, is the World Bank, who is represented by Mikaela Erbenova.
International Monetary Fund,
I'm sorry. It's not the World Bank. Because you are closely involved in the FSEPs, and that's where the confusion started. Okay, thank you very much for this. So I will not start to talk extensively. I will first indicate what are the different subjects that we agreed on. And the first one would be Greg Metcalf dealing with behavior economics, but also with investor protection. And in investor protection, I have two other people going to come in on retail investors. That's Stephen Mayor, is also going to deal with investor protection. And I think that Howard Whetstone may also say something on investor protection, dealing essentially then also with investors in capital markets. Cross-border issues, Ashley, you will deal with the cross-border because you are chairing this cross-border panel. And I would propose that you come the last because in your FSEPs, you have identified a number of what I would call critical points and also points of criticism. So it would be nice to introduce then in the next stage to introduce our debate. So the first would be, Greg, if you wanted to start, you have a microphone, so no difficulty to speak.
I certainly do. Can you hear me? Yes. Okay. Look, I think the question that is asked is the right level of regulation and investor protection. And I think at the end of the day, it's very simple. The right level of regulation, frankly, is pretty easy. It's one that obviously ensures that investors are confident and informed. And I say confident and informed, not necessarily protected, because when people participate in markets, they can lose money. So that's not necessarily protected. It's more about making sure they can be confident and informed. And also to make sure that the markets they invest in, they can be assured that they're fair, orderly, and transparent. You think about it, getting the right level of regulation is really just focusing on our objectives as securities regulators. And then if markets, if investors can be confident, and markets are fair and have integrity, the markets themselves can do their job of providing capital to fund economic growth. And I think it's quite important when you think about it that investors are confident from their point of view because, frankly, in order for many investors, the reason that retail investors in particular, their saving is often to provide for their retirement. And that is in turn to, can never really only be achieved by simply putting your money in the bank. It is actually about how you achieve capital growth over time. So it's important for individuals, but actually it's important actually for the economy to provide capital. So if you think about investors being confident and informed, I think what's important in the future is that I think we need to focus more on how investors make decisions. And I think what is, I think, a real leader for the future is I think we need, in terms of thinking, we need to think about how behavioral economics can in fact shape more policy in the future. I think it's really important, I think, the lessons that we see from behavioral economics in helping design regulation. And as you probably are well aware, I think that there are many examples where, you know, people are not necessarily rational, they're people. And it's what I call real regulation for real people. If we think about it, you know, there's not, you know, I've never met the rational investor. Maybe there's one here. I mean, they're real people. I mean, basically, investors, they've got biases for the present. They may be overconfident. Generally, behavioral psychology will actually tell you that people generally are positive about the outlook for the future. They also mistakenly think that an event is more representative than it actually is. And it also matters how choices are presented to them. So advertising is very important in terms of the way investors are presented with information. And in fact, it's actually not really even restricted to retail investors. As we know, the wholesale investors are often affected by they're human beings again. And I guess we saw a lot of this with the global financial crisis, where in fact, a lot of the behavior was not necessarily rational, but you need to perhaps look behind it to look at what was driving that behavior. So I do think behavioral economics can help us to understand the causes of problems we see in the markets we regulate, and to help us decide better on how and whether we respond. And I think the challenge for us is to get insights we can get from behavioral economics and actually use those to actually come up with smarter regulation. And I think the first step is to better understand the problems about why consumers choose particular financial products and sometimes not necessarily act in their best interest. And I think the groundbreaking work of the UK FCA, I think, can really be commended in this area, where they've recently prepared an occasional paper on behavioral economics. And I think it is it will become very important, I think, in shaping the way in which we approach what we do in the coming years. I think, for example, when we think about the issue of disclosure is actually, the purpose of disclosure is to provide information for which an investor can take a decision. It doesn't actually say it needs to be in paper, or it doesn't need to be, it's about actually getting effective disclosure. And I think, what we're learning, I think, is that, for example, investors often don't need, some investors want the critical information, others want a deeper level of information. So I think what we know these days that it's very, very important to make sure that it's multi-layered in terms of how information is provided, because often that's, people either don't have enough time or whatever, they need multi-layers so that they can get the layer they need to make a decision. Equally, in terms of thinking about behavior, people need multi-channels in which to actually access and process information. So, it means delivering that information. You may want to deliver it through a YouTube video, or more importantly, I think, through an e-learning module that presents and tests the comprehension of the information delivered. So I do think that we need to think more about, the effectiveness of what we're trying to achieve as security regulators, for example, in the area of disclosure. I think it's absolutely critical. So there's just a brief comment. I think that, we need to perhaps rethink the assumption behind regulation that investors are not necessarily rational. They're real people, and we should regulate for real people. And I think that is important then to the ultimate question, is what is the right level of regulation in terms of encouraging investor participation in the market? Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, Greg. I think you put your finger on a couple of absolutely essential points. Behavior economics is the topic of the day, you know that. But also effectiveness is extremely important. I think we, in our disclosure system, we are not looking too much at effectiveness. Mm. We're giving a lot of information, but that's it.
I think that's the issue. But now, if you think about the future is about mobile, video, and networking. Absolutely. And I think we need to now think about how, the tools we have today, paper-based disclosure and that, mm-hmm. I think we have great, exciting opportunities to think about how, and we can actually facilitate more innovative ways of actually facilitating information to be mm-hmm. analysed by investors. I think that is really important.
Yes.
I think it really should be something policymakers should be thinking about. And again, it goes to the heart of it. If investors can be confident about investing, then that is far better. Obviously that provides more capital for investment. That's a win-win.
Thank you. That's a win-win. Howard, you want to take it a little bit in a different direction?
Well, slightly, but not entirely. First of all, I really want to thank everyone for the opportunity to be here, and my colleagues and our host from Luxembourg, so thank you so much. And I don't mean to start this as a skill testing question, but I just want to follow up with what Greg said. So here it is. A baseball bat and a ball costs $110. The bat costs $100 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? Now, I'm not going to ask you to calculate that. I will give you the answer, though. The answer, maybe somebody should put up their hand, where's that little gadget that we had, is $110. Here's what I'm going to suggest to you when you think about it. Why do so many smart people get this question wrong? I think from that little description comment, you will understand how the challenges that we have with investor education, financial literacy, and the ability to understand exactly what it is that investors need to know. Now, I wasn't going to talk about this, but I couldn't resist given Greg's comments. Mark Jamieson of Florida once said that regulation in today's context means disappointing people at a rate that they can endure. Now, today I believe that there is a general agreement, despite what the media says, that we must complete the process of regulation stemming from the financial crisis. We're not done yet. I'm sure none of us needs to be reminded that we're only a few years from the worst financial crisis in memory. In fact, September 15th, 2013 marked the five-year anniversary of the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers. $739 billion in assets. The need to keep critical financial infrastructure, payments, clearing, retail deposits, etc., intact led to bailouts of $2 trillion of deficit-driven stimulus spending that will need to be serviced and repaid in the future. The point of this is that as we continue this important process, we must ask, what is the responsibility of securities regulators today to future generations? It's a type of law and economics consideration involving intergenerational equity. We need to ask ourselves, how will future markets judge our current supervision of markets? How effectively will the experience of the past 5 years inform our approach? And what is its very purpose? I think we can all agree, and Greg has talked about this a number of times today, that there are at least three key challenges facing regulators today: globalization, evolving market structures, and financial innovation and complexity. I should say that regulation has always been, in my opinion at least, about addressing problems with human behavior, not necessarily with technology. But certain technological and economic contexts provide some behaviors more opportunity than others to do exactly what it is that we don't wish it to do. It's clear that we cannot regulate virtue. Let me underline that. I think we all agree with that. But as one global bank recently put it, there is no piece of business, no deal, no revenue stream that is more important than our obligation to act responsibly, ethically, and within the rules. So the question is, how do we work through these challenges in making a more sound environment for today's and tomorrow's investors and our capital markets? One indication of that is in a letter that IOSCO wrote in 2008. Capital markets play an important role in the world's economies. It went on to say that IOSCO recognizes that investor confidence and transparency are fundamental to the success and liquidity of those markets, and that securities regulators are guardians of that trust. So, requiring high standards of conduct and disclosure supports the building of trust. Preventing or limiting unfair investor losses encourages investment. I would like to just point out two areas very briefly about what we should, in addition to what we've been talking about, and it's included in it, obviously, pay attention, and Greg alerted us to this, pay attention for future generations. And one is we need to pay attention to private markets. IOSCO is doing that. We are doing that as regulators, but we need to be mindful of the fact that investor confidence suffers, not just when there are losses in public markets. It also suffers when there are losses in private markets. And public securities now exist as only one of the numerous portfolio choices for sovereign wealth funds, pension funds, and hedge funds. The long-held assumptions of going public is the destiny of any large company, that stock markets are barometers of economic health, or that professional investors will be drawn to public markets to assist in ensuring efficient markets, are all concepts that are being challenged. If I don't need to tell this audience what the degree of wealth in sovereign wealth funds, it's approaching, by the way, $6 trillion in assets. And they are dropping their allocations to public markets, down to from 50% to 35%. Pension funds have already shown similar behavior. A recent FTSE 100 pension fund found that allocations to equities were approximately half of what they were in 2001. I don't need to tell you about the number of companies that are going private. And so as we think about this, we've talked about this area, as bank regulation evolves, market-based financing will continue to grow, making it more challenging to monitor and assess those risks. We need to do more to encourage compliance in those areas, and regulators need to ensure that they are able to supervise in these particular areas which are continuing to grow. Now, very quickly, I'll conclude my remarks by following up on a theme that Greg mentioned with respect to behavioral economics, and that is a 21st century regulator needs to evolve with the times. We are doing that in IOSCO with our 2020 plan, and I know that we will get there, Greg. The internet and explosion of information has profoundly changed the way goods and services are provided. Investing is no different. And as we look to the future and consider the right role for securities regulation, we have a choice. We continue with our traditional disclosure approach and tools of regulation, compliance, enforcement, and oversight, and hope that somehow the markets will get better and investors will come back in droves. Or we can take these tools and modernize them by harnessing the power of unprecedented access to information and social media, and recognizing the parallel development of private markets within and across our borders. Let me conclude by saying future generations call upon us to strike the right balance of regulation. They will do that. And now the paradox. Regulate too much, growth is stifled. Innovation withers. The market finds and builds bubbles in other assets, such as housing. Regulate too little, and we may enjoy some short-term benefits, only to find that our citizens have borrowed from the future in order to invest in schemes that have no hope of providing investment returns to fund their retirement and our economies. What do we want our legacy to be? Thank you, Eddie.
Thank you very much, Howard. Indeed, you see the spontaneous reaction of the room. It is very interesting perspectives that you are opening for us. On this private markets, I think it poses two questions. Number one, what are they? How do they function? How can we improve? But the second point is, do we need public markets? I want to raise this question, which is a little bit innovative, but at least let us think about it. Yes?
I was going to say, it's a very interesting issue why people are abandoning public markets, and it troubles me to think, is it because of things like high-frequency trading, etc., where they're not sure about what exact prices they're getting. And I think it's an interesting issue, this one, Howard, right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think my impression is, first of all, the public markets are very expensive markets to be in.
Yes, indeed.
And secondly, there are a lot of technological issues pushing the public markets, and we see that with respect to infrastructure and trading. We all understand that we're trying to come to grips with the pros and cons of high-frequency trading. It's not the only reason, for obvious reasons. But there are huge governance issues for public corporations in the public markets. Mm-hmm. I think that's another reason why we're seeing some of these. I didn't list them, but there are many. Toys for Us, perhaps our Canadian BlackBerry company will go private. Mars is going private, I think. Heinz is going private. And I think you're absolutely right. I wouldn't say that... those are the only reasons. But clearly, as I understand it, there's another issue here in which there's so much movement in this private market. And the private market, we all have them, and they vary a great deal. I mean, to some extent, the market-based financing, the shadow banking, much of that occurs, obviously, in the private markets. We all have what we generally call in Canada our exempt market. I think they have a similar kind of description in the U.S., and I'm sure many of our markets have that. But the bottom line here, I think, is that this private market is going to grow, and it's very clear we're seeing all the evidence of that today when we're seeing very large pension funds dropping their equity market participation, or at least in the public markets, and moving more to the private markets. A great deal of it's in direct investment, but there's also a considerable amount of indirect investment.
So it's a double tension on the buy side and on the sell side. You see it very clearly, and with lots of like Dell going private is quite interesting. Yeah. But I should continue with the panel. Although these remarks are extremely interesting, but the panel has to go on. I think my third speaker is Stephen Mayor, who also will deal with some of the retail issues. And that's the common denominator with this previous speaker. Stephen.
Thank you very much, Eddie, for giving the floor. And to briefly comment on this private-public issue, I think we shouldn't underestimate how many accidents there have been. And I think it can be a very important part for the professional market. But as a national regulator, I've seen some horrible accidents in the private part where the hurdle can be very low. So that is not to discredit that part of the market, but at the same time, I think there's a lower level of protection provided in the private sector. And I think also the public market, the public market gives an important signal to the state of the economy, the state of companies, and to some extent there's a free riding by the private market on the public market. Let me say before I start and continue on the topic that was already introduced by Greg and Howard, to thank IOSCO for allowing ESMA as a observer on the board. Thank you very much, Greg. We've been very active already on the international side, but it's very good to see that we are now formally recognized in the, let's say, the official institutional international structure. And we're looking forward to contributing to IOSCO and be a very active observer. But I think that that is a bit of a difficult combination. But we will, of course, respect the rules of the game. Okay, thank you very much. That is very good to hear. I would like to continue on the issue of financial consumer protection and see where we are in terms of the financial crisis. We are now 6 years into the financial crisis. We're starting to get, hopefully, to the end of the implementation of the regulatory reform, the design of the rules and the regulation, moving now in the implementation side. And I think we need to assess where we are in terms of financial consumer protection. And to be straightforward and honest on that, I think the achievements on the financial consumer side has been relatively modest if you look at the regulatory reform. There's been a very strong emphasis on the prudential side. There's been a very strong emphasis on the stability side. But if you're looking at the financial consumer side, I don't think we have progressed sufficiently. And in that sense, moving to, let's hope we're getting in the end part of the regulatory reform, we need to make sure is that financial consumer protection gets the right attention and is a solid building block of the regulatory reform. On that point, if you're looking for securities markets regulators, where we have been active, we've been active in derivatives, we've been active in regarding hedge funds, we've been active regarding credit rating agencies. That is all a very strong emphasis on stability issues, prudential issues. And of course, we know that in the end, the investors, the retail consumers will also benefit from prudential elements, from stability elements. But those pieces and those tools that really need to help protecting the financial consumer, I think we need to move more quickly on that part. In the EU environment, that would be, for example, PRIIPs, which is looking at the disclosure in structured products across the various sectors, and also on new rules regarding the distribution of products. A second element I would like to discuss is this issue of moving away from the classical, the neoclassical economics model where everything is driven by transparency and rationality and the idea that we need to move to behavioral economics, inspiring our work as a supervisor and as a regulator. I think I fully agree that we need to move beyond the neoclassical model of economics, and that this is not only about transparency, but that it raises very difficult issues. Once you move away from neoclassical economics, the idea that transparency should do the trick, that is a very clear policy implication for regulators, because it guides you in to say, please make sure that there is the right information in the prospectus, that there is the right information in the press release, and that the investor, the financial consumer, gets the right information. On the basis of the behavioral economics model, we're now going into the direction of possibly banning certain products, of intervening in the remuneration of the salespeople in investment firms, and we're also moving into the area of product governance and moving it closer into investment firms. But the question, of course, is how far should that go? Where is kind of the new border for the regulators, for supervision? Clearly, we need to move, but the question is somehow and somewhere we need to stop. We cannot take full responsibility for the decisions of investors. They have their own responsibility, and we know the more and the further we go in terms of things like product governance, banning certain products, it might also reduce the awareness at the consumer side. So I'm not disputing that we need to move and that we need to further, but the question is, where will be the new border? Other area that I would like to mention regarding consumer protection, where we need to focus on, is the whole issue of the interaction with the business model in the financial sector. As supervisors and regulators, we're trying to act when we see certain consumer detriment. But we know, of course, is that the level of consumer detriment is determined also by business models that are applied in the financial sector, by the remuneration systems, by the relationships between originators and manufacturers, the pricing arrangements, etc. And when we have certain incentives for poor treatment that increase the risk of poor treatment of investors, it's very difficult to repair that with supervision and regulation. So I think we also need to think, do we have the right models there, and do we need to think about banning certain or any changing certain models in the financial sector which have a high risk for resulting in consumer detriment. And for example, the classical examples in that area are the role of inducements in the case of advising certain products. How can you be an independent advisor when you're paid different inducements depending on the product that you advise? Mm-hmm. But we've also seen it very recently in the financial crisis where banks had to recapitalize. They had difficulty attracting the equity funding from the capital market, and they relied on their distribution network. And so there was a strong, a not disputed pressure to recapitalize, but also that resulted in a certain pressure on the distribution channel to trying to get equity source funding from their retail clients. And that has resulted also in certain accidents. Let me go to the final point that I would like to make on this new model supervision and regulation of financial consumer protection. It will be a model which is much more resource intensive and requires different techniques from the supervisor. The classical model, looking at transparency, is looking at stock prices, is looking at prospectuses. However, if you go to a model where you intervene, for example, in the governance at investment firms, where you look at remuneration systems, where you need to assess whether you would like to ban certain products, that requires much more supervisory resources. And I think it's an implication of that new model. And we need to think whether we have the right resources to credibly take this bigger role and having this more intrusive role. So these were the issues that I wanted to emphasize. I think we need to tackle all of these issues when we want to progress on the financial consumer protection agenda, but clearly we're lagging behind to the prudential and the stability side, and I think that is a risk overall for the stability of the system.
That's for the next phase. One, we have made the system stable, we can talk again about that, but for the moment it's still unstable. Yes, Howard, you would like to say something.
I think what you're raising here are really important, but they're and I agree with your characterization of economic models, Stephen. My personal experience has been twofold, and it's identifying what kind of regulator one needs to be in this particular environment. And what I mean by that is many, many years ago, I think, particularly in the developed economies, a clear decision was made around a disclosure-based system. And the purpose of it, of course, was investor protection and other reasons, obviously, but for the most part, transparency. And we have discussed to some extent the challenges associated with that today, and I think they're increasing. Whether or not the social media is the issue, or the complexity of the products, or the fact that a prospectus disclosure is really not worth the paper it's written on for an individual retail investor. And the real question is are securities regulators now moving towards a gatekeeper role? Mm-hmm. And if they're becoming more like gatekeepers, are they going to do what you're more or less implying, but not really saying you would do, which is to ban products, or maybe you are saying that. Because mm-hmm. you can work a lot with a firm and a product that they want to distribute, and you can work it so hard that eventually it doesn't reach the public. There is, and clearly, I think we all may do that. But the question then is, what is the appropriate role in today's market? Should securities regulators, in this very complex environment, take on a gatekeeper role? The second part of that, from my perspective, and I find this personally one of the most challenging areas of my own personal work, which is, how do you change a business model? How do you take a business model that has been in place for many years? You gave some examples. I can give you examples of, for example, funds with embedded fees that an industry has grown up on and enjoys. Or trailer fees an industry enjoys, and then you kind of say to yourself, you know what, this isn't a good product for investors. Over the long term, investors aren't making the returns that they expect that they should make with these investments. And then you work with industry, you consult with industry, you consult with stakeholders, and you know that the result has to be a change in the business model. And I personally find that very challenging, and I don't think industry accepts it very lightly whatsoever. I'm sure my colleagues have a comment on that. So just your comments raise those issues for me, and frankly, it just, from my own perspective, makes me very nervous.
Yes, Greg.
I was going to say, my view on this is a little bit different. I have a strong view that that actually product manufacturers and distributors, actually, I think it's rather than securities regulators getting involved with product governance, I think that the court system and the policymakers are going to make them more liable to the, you know, for the products that are, you know, basically where they're missold to investors. I think we're seeing a change after the crisis where we saw this happening where, you know, for example, the CDOs we saw around the world, either the courts or we saw regulators or we saw policymakers basically make credit rating agencies, product manufacturers or distributors made them liable for the losses of investors and said, look, if you sell a product that is obviously completely inappropriate for an investor, you will be held liable. And you've seen this, and we saw that recently in Australia where they sold CDOs to councils who had no idea what they were buying, and they held them liable. So I think I would push it back to product manufacturers and distributors to say, look, at the end of the day, you know, you want to make sure that the products don't end up with the wrong investor. It's actually either from a franchise perspective or from a liability perspective, because particularly from a liability perspective, it will come back and haunt you. And a very good example of that is PPI insurance in the United Kingdom with what the FCA has done and actually recovering huge amounts of money. I think it's running into the billions of product that was missold previously. So I guess my message to manufacturers is that you want to make sure that you've got in place good product approval mechanisms, new product committees to make sure that the wrong product doesn't get through to the investors and that you make sure the people that are distributing your product are the you know, the right people that will insure it, because at the end of the day you can't really wash your hands any longer to say, oh well, you know, that wasn't my fault. The courts and governments will see through it. And I think that's important. And I think it's back to my earlier comment about something like e-learning modules. I think it's really, I think they're a great way for product manufacturers to protect themselves, because at least, somebody who actually has an e-learning module and the information presented to them and there's a test of their comprehension, at least a manufacturer has the defense of saying, well, at least, the person who bought this product did the e-learning module and we were satisfied they understood what they were buying. And I do think this is something we've got to think more about, frankly. So I'm not necessarily for micromanaging the product process. I think it's back to manufacturers.
Stephen,
it's very good to hear that it makes Howard nervous. At the beginning, you already had quite a cynical description of a regulator that's kind of trying to control the number of disappointments at the public side. I fully agree that it's a more difficult role, but I think it's an inevitable direction where we need to go, because the transparency model is simply not sufficient, and that in itself also has resulted in disappointments at the side of the public and at the side of the side of the consumer. On the product banning, that seems to be and sounds very far-reaching, but we should realize that probably we all have withheld licenses for certain firms, some of them even being one product firm, and that is very close to banning a certain product. So you might already have done it in your life, Howard, and in that sense it's not completely new. I would also like to pick up on the point by Greg. In the end, on the point of banning certain products, it should be very exceptional. And I agree that there will be cases where even the industry would fully agree, because there are some accidents in some countries where it's not only the consumer that paid for poor products, but in the end, there was massive compensation, massive damage to the reputation of the financial industry. So I can see that in the end, it is a system which is beneficial both for the consumer side and the industry side.
That brings me to my naive question. Why do these producers put on the market products that are, I would call them, bad? Suppose that you are a manufacturer of cars and you want to sell your cars, and you know that some of your cars have no brakes, or it's clear that you can sell one car until it crashed and then it's finished with you. So why do producers of financial products have a different attitude? Why do they not incorporate in their own decision making this need of having products that are on the one hand safe or at least adapted to the needs of the clients? But I will not speak all the time. Ashley, it's your time on cross-border.
Well, I'm going to stay on the same topic for a second, because it's so important. I think I just want to say a couple of things about the remarks that made to date. Firstly, what has actually happened since the global financial crisis? A lot of focus has been on the prudential side, as mm-hmm. Stephen has mentioned, and not so much on the consumer protection side. But what the financial crisis has done is provided a golden opportunity for regulators to really think through what their role is. And I think it's the first time this has happened properly. So, for example, one of the core issues that, say, IOSCO, or a theme that underlies its discussions, is effectively what financial activity is purely speculative, what is financialization of the markets, and what is actually driving savings to investment efficiently with responsible, trusted intermediation. And that is a really core question about which we now fret a lot. And you've heard some of the thinking around this. The other thing I'd like to say is that the financial crisis, it should not be underestimated the degree to which populations lost trust in the system. And to Howard's point, I think, about private and public markets, I did hear a statistic that I think it was the UK public markets, it was demonstrated that more was being taken off the table in terms of share buybacks, privatizations and such like, than was being put on through IPOs, etc. That says a lot about the perception of public markets. And then finally, just in relation to product bans, etc., there are ways in which, and I think Greg alluded to this, there are ways in which regulators can shine a light on activity that causes that activity to change. If, for example, a product that's been manufactured is manufactured to be sold, but actually it's not wanted. And we've had in Hong Kong an example of this fairly recently with a product where we've shone a light on the commission structure, and the volume of that product has dropped quite significantly. The other aspect of this is, I think again has been alluded to, is product design. When one designs a product, one must have in view, and there must be internal controls within a firm to deal with this, one have in view who's it going to end up with and via whom and how as a manufacturer. And that responsibility, I think in the view of most regulators now from a consumer protection angle, needs to be embedded in the internal controls and other systems within banks. And then finally, I would say that the UK and one or two other European countries are looking at is not simply distributor-originator relationships, financial relationships, but also incentives within organizations, underemployment arrangements and such like, where employees may have warped incentives, frankly, to sell the wrong thing. So that's that. Sorry, that's not my topic. But
you were going to speak about cross-border.
I am. Very quickly. I'm going to make it much shorter than I was going to. Now we've been operating at about sort of at the very important, near sort of ground level. The cross-border thing is basically 30,000 feet. The you've seen coverage in financial newspapers using phrases such as fragmentation. There's the rows between the EU and the US. Asia gets involved. It's all really obscure, actually. It's very difficult to work out what's going on. So I'm just trying just to explain very, very quickly. Basically, you know, when the financial crisis happened, and it happened mainly in the West, not so much in Asia, but clearly had profound effects in Asia, there was an understandable rush to regulate. Around, again, as Stephen mentioned, mainly prudential issues, Basel III, resolution regimes for banks and things like that. And these reforms did fall under the umbrella of what the G20 in its famous Pittsburgh meeting did agree on as a global standard. But the fact is, and the reality is, there is no global rule book. And so we have a problem, which is that intensely global financial activity is subject to national rules. And I think it seemed to become much more of a critical issue that the application of national rules to global financial activity can lead to market fragmentation. And Mark Carney recently said, the FSB was basically giving information to the G20 for its St. Petersburg summit, and he said on the 2nd of September, the fragmentation of the international financial system that results from nationally focused policies could reduce global growth by putting up barriers to the efficient allocation of capital and liquidity. Basically, that means it could crimp growth and affect real economies, because you're impeding efficient capital allocation. So, and an example of this, a recent example, which the financial industry, I think, have got hold of and they keep pointing to with some degree of alarm, is the Fed in the United States and its requirement that foreign bank branches effectively subsidiarize and hold a capital pool within the United States, and the criticism of that voiced by the industry and others is that how does that fit with the idea of a global resolution regime? There's another area which has got a huge amount of press. Again, it's difficult to understand. It's around derivatives. But effectively, it's the same issue. It's the natural inclination of countries to protect their populations when they feel that there might be something happening outside, particularly via their own global banks, that might come back to hit their own populations. And it's perfectly natural that countries would tend to try to extend their rules to capture those dealing with their own banks overseas so that it doesn't come back to harm their own populations. But the, although that's natural, the negative side is as pointed out by Mark Carney and others. So the question is, what are we doing about it? Actually, quite a lot. All I'd say is that firstly, the, you know, the people sitting on this panel, Greg and Stephen, we all to participate in a group which is focused on derivatives regulation. It's met 4 or 5 times. It's going to meet again in Paris this week. And there's been a sea change in attitude whereby the regulators have a genuine willingness to try and sort this out on a practical level. We're not there yet, but we've come a long way from when we started off 18 months ago, without any doubt. And in particular, there was a sort of picked up in the St. Petersburg G20 statement where the G20 leaders said, we want you to continue working on techniques whereby you defer to foreign regimes in the cross-border, when there's cross-border financial activity, when that foreign regime is a quality regime. Now, that begs a lot of questions. It is those questions we're trying to sort out. Finally, Greg mentioned the role of IOSCO in this. Clearly, there's a question, which is, IOSCO is our collective as global regulators. The question is, what is the relevance of the international standards and principles that IOSCO produces? They should be significant, and clearly they are an opportunity to deal with these cross-border issues. Again, we're not there yet, partly because those standards and principles in some areas are not detailed enough. Certainly that's what, you know, many regulators would see, depending on the activity. But clearly there's a big question mark and an opportunity for IOSCO to may play a much bigger role in this. And secondly, there's an opportunity for IOSCO to play a role potentially in the future as a location for the discussions around cross-border comparability and trying to sort out potential conflicts between rules. The final thing I'd say is, and this is just my personal view, but I think others share it, IOSCO is incredibly useful, I think David referred to this, for regulators to get together and get to know each other personally. Frankly, setting aside all the technicalities, what that does is build up trust. And one way in which one aspect on the whole cross-border issue I think we should work on really, really carefully is, and again it's longish term, is supervisory cooperation. Because if you build up a system of memorandum of understanding and other arrangements whereby you work together to supervise financial institutions cross-border that have a foot in one jurisdiction and a foot in another and another, what you will end up doing is you'll be able to roll back the degree to which there's an extraterritorial application of rules and replace that with supervisory cooperative mechanisms, thereby reducing the tension and then achieving, I think, what Mark Carney was trying to get at, which is let's reduce some of these barriers. So that's all I had to say about cross-border, but I think it's an incredibly important topic.
Yes, indeed. I will not comment on that except for one point. If you see how we resolve conflicts in private law with conflict of interest rules, can we not find something similar here?
I should have mentioned, together with Anne Lachey of the Swiss FINMA, we're leading this task force on IOSCO to tackle this very subject. It's been specifically set up to do this. Partly my inspiration, it wasn't actually conflicts of laws in places like law firms and such like, but when I was, I think, back in university doing a law degree, the one subject I found to get really, really difficult to get to grip with is a subject called conflicts of laws. So this is 35 years later. I'm going to finish the job now.
Thank you. Okay, next. Yes, write the book. Yes, oh yes, please.
I was just going to say, on the issue of relying on one another, I think the common theme that's come out of this group on derivatives is that we've recognised that, in fact, we actually are looking to achieve the same outcomes. That, you know, it's about making sure investors are confident and informed in our markets and fair, orderly and transparent. And I think as I said earlier, I think there's more that we have in common that divides us, and I think that is sort of the good faith that's really coming out in how we can rely on one another. We're actually looking for equivalent outcomes, and mm-hmm. I think mm-hmm. whether it be in enforcement or in supervisory, I think that is a common element. So I think that's the end game, and I think that's how you try and overcome conflicts, is to actually realise at the end of the day you've both actually got common outcomes you're trying to achieve. So I do think we can move more to better supervisory cooperation, just like we've moved with enforcement cooperation, actually.
But on derivatives, you have some experience, which was in the beginning not perfect. But
you know what? It's like anything. People need to sit down and talk together and face one another, and often realise that, you know, sometimes people can be talking across purposes, and sometimes you just got to get them to realise, in fact, they're actually talking the same outcome. It's just getting that communication. It's all about people and making sure that there's a good exchange. I think that, and that's how I think we've ended up with good outcomes on overseas, the derivative regulators forum, actually. Mm-hmm. Just people talking it through, talking through the issue.
It's certainly helped in the case of derivatives is that we got together quite early on in the process and at the highest level and met, I think, every 2-3 months. And that has really helped to get the process going. On the role of IOSCO, what I would like to suggest also is that what we're seeing now, of course, is that in the end, we still need to rely on sovereign decision-making by regions, by countries. And there are some of the opportunistic reasons behind it, what you're saying, Ashley, but also there's the real situation is that as regulators, we have to work with different prime rules, prime regulations, which are difficult to, let's say, reconcile at the international level. One area I think where IOSCO can help is trying to have as much as possible already the ideas for possible future regulations available, and having to some extent a template is maybe a very simple word. But what you see, for example, for credit rating agencies is that the systems there are very similar across the world. Why? Because they've borrowed heavily from the early template mm-hmm. from IOSCO. So I think IOSCO can have a role in terms of trying to sense where possible future regulatory action might come from the governments and steer that debate. And of course, completely understanding that these are sovereign decisions, but the more there is already a kind of a concept available, the easier it also will be to, after the legal process has been completed, to reconcile that and try to get to a consistent system.
I agree. Recent example of that, I think, at the board meeting this week was crowdfunding, where exactly a great example where we see many countries wanting to develop crowdfunding, and we said, well, actually, this is an ideal area where we need to perhaps look at a global approach. So I think you're right. We've got to be, though, sufficiently forward-looking to be ahead of that game. I agree completely.
I think Stephen's absolutely right. It's difficult because, like any area of activity, it's a resourcing issue. Particularly for IOSCO, and I think David alluded to that. But there is, I think, a very good reason for an organization like IOSCO to get ahead of the curve by deciding which areas of cross-border activity are the most important, or which areas, or which firms are most important, etc., and then focus on that, and then think very, very hard about the sort of principles that IOSCO as a group wants to put in place, and then that would have exactly the effect that I think Stephen is suggesting. It makes the national authorities, mm-hmm. they would have a reference point before they start. That's what happened in this crisis. There was a rush to regulation, totally understandable, and now we're trying to sort out the conflicts between them.
I just might like to add to that by saying that I think we've all come to the conclusion of regarding the concept of interconnectedness. It seems to be very current. I think we've all accepted it. We need to look no further than a financial crisis to believe in it. And my thought about this is, besides IOSCO's ability to be able to put some of this work together and think through the issues, I think what ultimately is really important here, and I would not like to turn this into an economic discussion, but I will say this, that without a full understanding, in my opinion, of the issues associated with cross-border issues and conflict and gaps, we will increase the cost of our respective jurisdictions doing business, which I don't think is a positive thing for our respective jurisdictions. And we also will create, I think, certain bottlenecks and difficulties to be able to compete effectively in a global environment. If there is such a thing as, for example, competition in securities amongst jurisdictions, the desire to ensure they have regimes which will support business and also protect investors, I think we have a global obligation to get our heads around this, because our respective jurisdictions will suffer economically, I believe, in critical areas without resolving some of these issues and having a very good understanding of how we can deal with them. So, as I say, as a securities regulator, perhaps economic growth is not part of my domain, but I clearly believe that securities and positive securities regulation and informed securities regulation is an important part of economic growth for all of our countries. So I think that's an underlying component for me that I think is very critical.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. Okay, we'll stop it here. Michaela, it's your turn.
Yes. Very much. Women have a reputation for being practical, and IMF staff have a reputation for being geeks and number people, so I'll try to live up to both of these reputations at once, and we'll actually use a PowerPoint to support that. But first of all, I would like to thank the organizers for the opportunity to join this very distinguished panel, and generally to the IOSCO of inviting the International Monetary Fund into some of the deliberations of the past days, because for us it's a very important opportunity to learn from all of you about your concerns and about the developments in your respective markets, but also maybe to share with you some of our views which are informed by the global community of the IMF membership, which we subject to our surveillance. With that, I would like to share with you quickly the observations from the field. And those are from the Financial Sector Assessment Program, which we conduct since 1999 for emerging and developing economies together with our colleagues from the World Bank, to assess jurisdictions as to how they are doing in aspiring to these global standards of supervision and regulation as formulated and embodied in the IOSCO principles. And those provide us with very important and granular information about the challenges which regulators on the ground face nowadays. Well, in a nutshell, I would like to say that there has been a lot of progress since we started doing these assessments. And indeed, if you wish to look at the average grades assigned in these FSAPs, global regulatory community has improved in a number of areas over time. But there is also a second leg of the stool, which is that regulators still have a long way to go, not only to face the emerging challenges which we have all discussed here, but also to address the known ones. And the lessons from financial crisis have been translated into a number of very important initiatives which affect securities regulators in many ways, and the industry as well. And so, just seconding Ashley, it is growing ever more important for us to maintain momentum in implementing all these reforms in a very consistent manner to avoid the risk of cross-border spillovers and regulatory arbitrage. And IOSCO standards provide a very important benchmark in that respect. Now, when we conduct the IOSCO assessments, we try to look and answer two questions. First, which is a micro question, which is basically how does the regulatory framework and supervisory practice on the ground enable investors to make these informed decisions about which Greg spoke? So how does it help supervisors to address properly risks coming from the market structure and from particular activities? And then there is a second, more important question, perhaps in light of the recent crisis lessons, which is, how does that relate to the capacity of a regulator to identify emerging and systemic risks? So I will turn to both of these questions now. This is a chart showing global compliance with the IOSCO principles and the more important, if you will, bar is the blue one for each principle, which is the latest 2011 methodology. A word of caution here is we have obviously done many more assessments under the old methodology, which is superimposed here to the corresponding principles of the new methodology. So the content of the principles coincides. So I'm showing here 77 jurisdictions for the 2003 methodology and only 9 for the 2011 methodology. So some of the differences are to some extent a statistical artifact in that it is generally the case that larger and advanced jurisdictions which are represented much more in the newer sample generally show better compliance with some of the principles, such as, for instance, the formal powers and resources, which are shown in Principle 3. But some of it is real difference and real progress. So what you see here is percentage of countries which have undergone our assessment, which is well more than 100, that have received partly or not implemented grade for the corresponding principle, i.e. the two worst ones. And the green line is simply half, 50%. So at the surface, the picture is relatively optimistic because obviously there are very few of these bad grades, and there are some notable improvements for many principles. But there are also some notable outliers, which are the ones I would like to talk about. Those related to supervisor independence, those related to supervision and enforcement. And then one needs to look at the greater depths into what our assessors actually tell us in these assessments. So let me start with the first one. This is a chart showing global compliance with Principle 12, which requires experts to make a judgment on the quality of supervision and the quality of enforcement. And what you see here, and in the commentary to the Principle 12, is a conclusion that both supervision and enforcement are not intrusive enough. The chart again shows a percentage of countries that are rated as partially implemented or not implemented for this principle in the 2011 and 2003 methodology. Now, that is maybe evidenced a bit more granularly, if this works, on this chart, which shows a compliance for constituent principles which show supervision of different parts of the market. Now, and you see also here that there is an issue with supervision, particularly for collective investment schemes and intermediaries. Well, why does it matter? What our assessors tell us is that far many regulators are dedicated very limited resources to on-site work. Now, very often that is justified by them implementing risk-based approaches, whereby you use some criteria to identify firms that pose the highest risks and focus then your supervisory resources there. That seems very rational and sound approach for as long as you are actually able to robustly identify these risks. And I would submit that for that you would need on-site work to complement your periodic reporting, market intelligence, and complaints, particularly in this new era where there are so many new and emerging risks we don't know about and challenges coming from, for instance, lessons of a crisis and lack of trust of public. Because your reporting cannot easily capture conduct issues, even though you could have proxies in your framework. It is entirely dependent, in particular, on the firm's willingness to be accurate and on their capacity to report robustly conduct issues as they arise. And complaints are a second-hand product, too, in a sense, because customers would complain only when they lose the money or when they find out that they lost the money, which could even that be with some lag. And by then, the risk has materialized. So the importance of on-site work is what we would like to stress and what we do find out as deficient in many of the assessments. Now, secondly, you could have clusters of risk, which are present in a number of small players, but which aggregate together could become systemic. Mis-selling in one tiny firm is not an issue for as long as it's not replicated across a large number of those small firms. Now, how do you find that out? We would think that, you know, having your feet hitting the ground is the best way to find it. Maybe with a thematic review across the range of the firms, across the sample, rather than relying on these offsite techniques entirely. Now, the second part of that same principle, which is related, is that supervision, of course, goes hand in hand with enforcement. And there, our FSUBs indicate that there are problems. Now, ultimately, no matter what is the paradigm we all accept for supervision, you need an enforcement framework. And the goal of that enforcement framework would be to affect behavior in a desirable way. Now, for that, you have a number of elements which need to be in place. You need to have obligations on firms which are sound and clear. But you also need remedial actions and punitive actions to affect behavior. And what we find in our assessments is that in great many countries, securities regulators do focus on remedial actions at the expense of punitive actions. And where they do apply sanctions, those tend to be oftentimes trivial, a trivial cost of business for large firms, and thus are not effective in achieving early compliance by the regulated entities. And again, that is largely independent of the overall paradigm of supervision as to the goal of it. To be a credible supervisor, you need to be able to enforce the framework that you have publicly communicated is your desirable one. Now, the second part is even more tricky in that criminal enforcement remains a challenge in our experience across a majority of jurisdictions. Now, criminal enforcement is usually outside of the control of securities regulators. And in many countries, for reasons one could understand, it is not a priority of the criminal authorities either. But then that in turn translates into very limited resources to pursue these cases and the lack of effectiveness. So even though that is a difficult issue to tackle for regulators alone, it is a very important one, and cooperation with the criminal authorities needs to remain on our radar screen. Now, last of these micro issues, and an area which is found consistently as a weakness, is supervisor independence. That is an ability of supervisors to fulfill their mandate without undue political or industry interference. Now, that is captured in principle 2 in the methodology, but it is really strongly linked and interwoven into the whole framework of IOSCO principles, because you need to have adequate resources and legal powers for supervisor independence to be meaningful. You need governance and accountability and transparency to support operational independence over time. And then again, operational independence is critical for both the willingness and ability of supervisors to act achieve their outcomes. Now, in practice, it is very difficult to assess whether an agency is independent or not, particularly during the boom years, where arguably it is more needed, because there you would have less of a need for many actions which come to roost in the crisis. And then also finding conclusive evidence of direct acts of political interference is hard for outside parties. And if even they, such as our assessors, are able to find that evidence, then probably independence has been already severely damaged. But it doesn't mean that it is not important. It is something that our community should strive to support, and it should be a priority moving forward. Now, it's interesting to look at this chart, I think, because in some ways we have come a long way, and if you read the assessments, they usually no longer indicate that blunt political interference is happening into the decisions of supervisors. Yet if you look at this chart, it shows that compliance got worse under the new principles and recent assessments. And I think part of the answer is that there is a higher bar post crisis because we have recognized how important this is, but also because we have come to understand there are many subtle and nuanced ways in which independence of supervisors could be challenged by industry and by authorities, and in which it can affect supervisory ability to act, for example, by cutting resources to specific areas or by various means of public campaigns, which make regulators less effective in getting their message across. So, it is difficult but very important, and we think it should be an important priority on our minds going forward. Now, last but not least, turning to macro question, we have discussed a bit the need to include this new paradigm into our supervision, and that is indeed one of the important lessons of the crisis, that securities market and intermediaries can be cause or at least a transmission mechanism for systemic risk. And so in response, IOSCO has formulated these two principles dealing with systemic risks and with the need to identify emerging risks and regulatory perimeter. Now, an identification of these risks is in many ways a new mandate for all of us. And as a community, we are struggling in understanding what would be the best practice to achieve that mandate. That is, in a sense, reflected in these assessments where, on the surface again, they do not indicate there could be a problem because half of the countries have been assessed as compliant under these principles. Now, here is where statistical artifact comes into play. Because there are no best practices, because we are all grappling in understanding how to operationalize this requirement, where countries have been downgraded under these principles, it was usually where the gaps were judged by assessors as outright blunt. And where they were not able to make that determination, they would rather concentrate, especially in the early assessments, on commentary. And when one goes through the commentary, then again the picture is much more nuanced because there are many references in the FSUPs to the fact that to be able to do this work properly, supervisors do need data, skilled staff, and very often a new toolkit. And all of these are big challenges. There's clearly a question of whether all the agencies have clear strategy on the collection of the use of data, whether they have powers to collect these data which are not individual firm-based data but which are data meant to serve as proxies for systemic risks. There is a big expertise dilemma where many regulatory agencies are grappling with the need to have staff experienced in very specialized areas of understanding market dynamics, and as well as economists who could bring additional macro picture into the discussion. And there is finally a question of a toolkit. Now, to end here, is the challenge of international cooperation and consistency, which comes into this principle very strongly. Now, the crisis has brought to bear a realization of increased interconnectedness of the markets. And so identification of the risks cannot be done by isolation by a single supervisor. Addressing risks also requires cooperation. Greg has alluded to very important work which IOSCO is doing in this area, and I think going forward, IOSCO should continue playing an important role in this area too, by encouraging all of us to find common approaches to identify these emerging risks and to mitigate the challenges of inconsistent regulatory approaches at the global level. I think that's where I would like to end.
Yes, thank you very much, Michaela. I think time has come to ask for questions from the floor. We have another 12 minutes left. I see that the first question is always the most difficult.
Sure.
But yes, I see You must all be satisfied with the explanations given. Michaela, to come back on your last point, it is clear that there is a difficulty in enforcement, in transmission of IOSCO standards to the level, the national level, and then a question of enforcement. And of course, you see a lot of differences in enforcement between very clear statistics on insider trading are very well known. Europe is much more lenient and was much more lenient, perhaps changed a little bit now in the UK, but was much more lenient on insider trading than the US. And the question is, why? Why are the Europeans, is there less insider trading? Number one, the answer is probably not. And the second question is the fact that the US is using much stronger investigation methods, the explanation, number one, and number two, once they find cases, of course, their intervention is very drastic. We know that, huge fines and so on. So have you taken sufficiently into account the differences of the background, of the setting in which these things are developing?
Well, you know, the principles are global for good reason. So they are, of course, a negotiated set of practices, and in that sense, one could argue that they do embody, to some extent, national practices, otherwise they would not be endorsed by IOSCO membership. On the other hand, they are meant to be a global standard, and they are meant to allow the supervisory community to move towards a shared vision of what constitutes best practice in the field. And so in that sense, I think it would be counterproductive if they were just a minimum common denominator. Now, part of the difference you alluded to is also, of course, a difference in the legal practice, but and you know, legal system in general, which gives different role to public authorities versus, say, court system in these two areas of the world, which you mentioned. And there are other important differences in other countries, but I think what is common and what should be embodied in the practices is that it is not enough to have just remedial actions which tell firms to fix the problems. And behavioral economists have been mentioned far too often on this panel, but thereby lies another lesson here, that without the punitive element, or without the you being seen in the shadow of the punitive element, which could hit you unless you behave in a particular way, chances that supervisors will be able to affect the behavior in a desirable way are rather slim.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Howard? Yes, Stephen?
Well, maybe on the... I won't comment on, let's say, the differences across the world, but I think in general you can say that looking at the pre-crisis mode, before the crisis, I think there was a tendency, and that is not only for securities markets regulators, but also for insurance and banking regulators, there was a tendency to rely on systems, to be a relatively high-level regulator. There was, of course, also clear pressure for the perspective that we should, you know, there should be sufficient leeway for markets to develop. And I think not only for securities regulators more broadly, I think we have learned the very hard way is that regulation and supervision to be credible, it needs to be intrusive, it needs to be on site, and there needs to be, when it's appropriate, there needs to be enforcement. But that is not an easy change to make. Being a, in some cases, a tough regulator is not what most people like to be. It's, at the one hand, we are working very closely with the financial sector, which is completely justified because there's complexity, we need the consultations, we need to have the feedback on our interventions. But then to move subsequently to a much tougher mode is for many people a difficult move to make. So I think you can see across the world that regulators and not only securities markets are going in that direction of being more on-site, being more intrusive, and also moving more to enforcement. But that is not a decision or a change you can make easily. It requires a certain new generation also of supervisors to make that change.
Yes. Ashley, yes, and then it comes to you.
I think one thing that the IMF work has really pointed out is this question of enforcement often doesn't get enough attention post-financial crisis. And I think a good example of that, you can see that as I mentioned earlier, the focus was on prudential fixes to put to build in safety buffers in the system.
Yes, yes.
Next thing, though, that happened as that was going down was LIBOR.
Yeah.
Now, LIBOR changed the game because there was the realization that LIBOR was nothing about. There's nothing to do with capital requirements, nothing to do with leverage. It was to do with behavior. And it comes down to this point about trust in the system. And the role of securities regulators as, like it or not, tough enforcement agencies is absolutely vital because the messages that sends out to alter the perception of the public about the system and rebuild trust is absolutely vital. And that's a component of what securities regulators, that what they do, which doesn't fit within the sort of prudential approach to the financial crisis, and which, you know, I think many agencies, including ourselves, although Stephen says it's tough doing it, we do it. Mm-hmm. Because it's absolutely critical.
Well, see what they do in Canada.
I don't want to make this too homegrown, but obviously enforcement is critical. And I think my impression of enforcement is if you want to increase enforcement, you very simply need to dedicate and develop an enforcement strategy. And it's not simply about hoping that you'll achieve more enforcement. It really requires a dedicated approach to increasing enforcement in a jurisdiction, which in course means having the right staff, the right tools, support from governments to have those tools. It also means developing important relationships with the police or police forces and working very together to achieve criminal enforcement if that's what you're attempting to achieve, or regulatory if that's what you're attempting to achieve. I think we all agree that the principles of deterrence in all of our countries and economy is important. And so I think you really need to dedicate the time and effort to enforcement. It's a difficult choice because we all have limited resources, and enforcement just swallows up resources enormously. And until you do one of these cases personally, it just is so remarkably time-consuming and difficult, affected and impeded by the rule of law. Mm-hmm. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm a great supporter of the rule of law, but you know, individuals who are being investigated have rights. And the consideration of the legal responsibilities enforcement are vast. And so I really believe it's important. My only message here, and I agree with what's been said, that you really need to dedicate it and create an enforcement strategy if you want to achieve greater enforcement. The other thing I would say is that much of what we're seeing is a great deal more of global enforcement. Global enforcement has created more and more challenges, and many of our jurisdictions are now dealing cross-border. You talked about the MOU, 2,000 information sharing requests, and that's a very important component, and much of our enforcement is facilitated by the cooperation that we have with other jurisdictions. And without it, I think we would have even a lesser amount of enforcement in our jurisdiction. The only other thing I would say about the approach, I mean, historically, it's possible, perhaps with the exception of some jurisdictions, that enforcement has been secondary to other remedial action. I think compliance sweeps are critical. We're doing more of it in Toronto at the OSC. We're doing more compliance sweeps. We realize we need to do more because we're discovering more. It takes time, it takes resources, and you need to develop certain skills to do that. So in the context of enforcement, which is a very important agenda, I believe, and since the financial crisis, and as Ashley said, the only way we're going to restore trust to the public is to ensure that they feel they have a chance in the markets. And one of the only ways of that occurring is to increase enforcement. My last comment, Carmen, would be as follows. Whenever I go to dinner, whenever I go to a cocktail party, wherever I go, even to the golf club, Mr. Wright, the one thing that everybody talks to me about is, why isn't there more enforcement? Nobody's asking me any questions about derivative regulation. They just want more enforcement. So what that means to me is the public feels that we need to have more enforcement, and so we need to dedicate ourselves to that.
Claps. I actually tend to agree. Unfortunately, I think back to behavioral economics, I think there are two classes of people. those that actually fear getting caught, and the, you know, there's a fear versus greed. And I think, unfortunately, some particular industries, people are driven by, you know, fear versus greed. And if in fact the trade-off looks like you can get away with it, and therefore you'll do it. So, and then there are other sectors where, you know, ethics play a higher role, and there's less driver. And I do think, unfortunately, you've got to face reality in terms of behavioural science, which is, you need to tailor yourself to the way people think. And I agree with Howard. Unfortunately, if people feel the chance of getting caught is less, then often they'll react appropriately. So therefore, you've got to increase that fear. And that's why also another aspect, I think, in many jurisdictions, the sanctions for white-collar crime are too light. And people think, oh, well, I'll take the gamble. So, you know, I do think, I agree with you. I think it's all part of the equation. I think enforcement is important.
Mm-hmm. So we agree that enforcement is important, and I think we agreed beforehand, but nevertheless, we have said it very clearly. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now coming at the end of this panel. If there are no further questions, there are perhaps a few points on which I would like to draw your attention. Indeed, the importance of behavioral economics. The question is, to what does that lead us? And that would be very interesting to have a list of the topics where we can undertake action.
Which profession is to watch?
Oh, but there are plenty. there certainly are plenty. The other point is the private market. So what I was very impressed with what you said, and it is the shift from public to private markets, which is a little bit destabilizing. So the question is what to do about it. Should we go that direction? I think it's for confidence and trust, it's probably not the best thing. One of the points I thought, which was rarely mentioned, was incentives. And I think, Stephen, it was you that made a little bit allusion to that. If you have incentives that go in a conflict of interest situation, and that's the one you are referring to, I mean, the broker selling with a fee for himself, I think there is something that has to be done there. Mm. The question is, we have exactly the same problem in the credit rating agencies, the same problem in the auditors, which we discussed during the break. So there's further reflections. Further reflections. I also liked the idea that IOSCO should intervene very early in policy setting and in regulatory dialogue. I mean, that's absolutely essential. And I remember what you said in derivatives. I was part of it in the previous phase. I think it was going in the right direction. The role of IOSCO, while I see a lot of things there, cross-border, exchange of views and cooperation, creating awareness, creating trust, and I can probably go on for many other objectives. And the last point is, how to put all these rules in operation. And I think at the national level, yes, I think we are very thankful for the FSAPs because they make it clear what is going on in many, many jurisdictions which otherwise we will never be able to look at. So it's good to have some statistics. What the statistics cover, of course, that's another question. That is for further analysis. Greg, I see that you...
I was actually saying the FSAPs are our report card,
yeah.
Actually.
Yes.
You think about it, if we have standards, the FSAPs actually go out and actually see how well they're implemented.
So absolutely.
I think they are an important report card collectively for us at IOSCO, and I think probably they're an important outcome we need to be focusing on for the future, actually. I'm not sure we do enough of that at the moment. So, yeah.
Things can be improved, but at least what we have is already quite good.
It's always a journey.
Yes, absolutely. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of this panel. It remains me to thank the five panelists, all high-level panelists, and I hope you enjoyed this very very interesting and very motivating exchange of views. So thank you very much.